And now we begin a new medrash. So take a look at the sheets for number 9, please. This is a fun one, which isn't to say the other ones aren't. But this one is fun. This, first of all, I have to correct myself. Here you run into an interesting problem when you read medrash. And that is that different editions of the Medrash, as we've been pointing out since the beginning of the year, have some slight variations, but also that different editions of Medrash will actually break up the Midrashim differently. So that last week, I told you that we were starting on a 5 Medrash series about the building of the boat and the design for the boat and so on. So when I looked at it again in preparing this week's Medrash, I realized that the edition that I actually prefer to use has it as 7 Midrashim. So we may end up doing it in fewer weeks because some of them are very small. But I will correct myself to say 7 Midrashim. The only practical application of it for you is that when you want to keep your sheets in order and you see at the top of the page it says 31:9 and then it'll say 10 and 11 and so on. So it's going to be 31:8 through 31:14 are going to be the Midrashim that are dealing with the building of the boat. Other than that, you don't need to worry about this at all. In any case, this series is about the materials, the dimensions, and the values involved in the design of the boat, and this medrash is going to be a very good example of it. We've already learned that building the boat is a maaseh mitzvah, is a mitzvah action, with details assigned by God as part of the mitzvah. So now we're going to see what that means. If you take a look at the top source, source number 1, this is, once again, the sentence that God uses when he begins telling Noach to build the boat. Asei lecha tevat atze gopher. Make for yourself a boat of gopher wood. Kinim ta'ase et hateva. And I'm not translating the rest of the sentence yet. So last week when I brought you that sentence, I rendered kinim as residences, places to live. But the literal meaning of the word kinim is what I used here on this sheet, which is nests. A kan, or a cane, is a nest. And what's going to bother our medrash is why we used the word kinim. That's not the Torah's normal word to describe a residence. If you take a look at source number 2, we get one example, or 2 examples in one sentence. Visharatz hayor tzifar de'im. This is the warning about the plague of frogs in Egypt. So it says, the river will teem with frogs. Ve'alu, and they will ascend, uva'u, and they will enter, bivesecha, your house. That would have been a good word for what he's supposed to create on the boat. Batim ta'aset hateva would have been very good. Ubachadar mishkavcha, and the room in which your bed is, your bedroom. Cheder is a fine biblical word. So why not say, chadarim ta'aset hateva? Why do you need to use this word kinim, which means nests? So you may tell me, well, there are birds on the boat, so therefore you need nests for the birds. But tell that to the lion. Right? The lion's probably embarrassed. No wonder he bit Noah. For a year, he's been cooped up in this nest. What is this idea here? We find other uses of these words. When Yosef decides to retreat from his brothers because he's very emotional, it says, he entered the cheder. So why couldn't we use the word cheder here or use batim? Batim works just fine. So first of all, let's look at the word kinim as it appears elsewhere in the Torah. There are 3 times in Chumash where the word kain or kan is used. Kinim as the plural only appears here. But if you take a look at source number 3, we find Cain or Kan. One is in Bamidbar. Bilam, when he blesses the Jews, says, I'm sorry, well, not when he blesses the Jews. This is actually to the Caini. It's a play on words. Here's another case of, you could say, paranomasia. You got it. It's a play on words. What happens is Bilam, in his last message before he leaves the Jews, having failed to curse them, so he addresses the various nations he sees around them, and he turns to the Keni, and he says, Eitan Moshavecha v'sim basela kinecha. So it's a play on Keni, kinecha. And he says, your dwelling is strong and your nest is in the rock. He's marveling at how the Keni are going to endure even after the Jews enter the land of Canaan. And we know that, of course, in the Haftarah this week. This week is Parsha Zahor. Make sure to be in shul to hear Zahor. And and in the Haftarah, we're going to read about Shaul going to war against Amalek and warning the Keni to get out of the way. So the Keni do just fine. So there we see a nest, right? Kinecha, your nest. The next reference is a mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, that if I want to take the eggs from a mother bird's nest, I have to shoo away the mother bird first. Ki yikarei kan tzipor lefanecha. When a bird's nest, kan tzipor, happens before you. And then the third reference is from Parshat Ha'azinu. Kinesher Yair Kino al Gozalav Yerachev. We describe Hashem's protection of the Jews. And it says, like a nesher, I didn't translate the word nesher because it could be eagle or vulture, and vulture is considered the more accurate, but it's just too ugly an image. So, like a nesher arousing its nest, fluttering over its young. So, in all three cases, it's a nest. It's very clearly bird-associated. I sort of wonder about other associations with the word kain or kan, like kinyan and mikna and things like that, but I don't really have much to go with. But the question that our medrash is bothered by is, why does the Torah use the term specifically for a bird's nest instead of a term for general residences? You follow the question? Once again, it is the medrash's wonderful ear for language. Because I've read that sentence, I don't know how many times over the years, and never thought twice about it. But the Medrash is paying attention. Very short Medrash, it's source number 4. Contrast that with the 3-part Medrash we just spent a week and a half on. Very short Medrash. Kinim ta'ase et hateva, kilin umidorin. Rooms and residences. I couldn't actually do anything with the word kilim, but Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, who was a great halachic authority of about 700, 800 years ago, and who also wrote a commentary to Rashi's commentary on the Torah, he's the one who translates kilin as rooms. It sounds like a Greek word. So I went hunting in Greek for like kilos or kilos or something like that. The closest thing I could find is what I gave you in source number 5, which is, those are Greek letters, obviously. Greek to me too. It's kolos, those letters, and that's a hollow space. So maybe kilin is somehow associated with that. That's the best I could do. But in any case, kilin umidorin are rooms and residences. As a matter of fact, we're going to see in another few midrashim down the line that there are hundreds of rooms described on this boat. The Medrash is going to say there are hundreds of these rooms. And Amar Rabbi Yitzchak explains, Ma hakan hazeh mitaher es hamitzora, av tevascha mitaharascha. This nest purifies the Mitzorah, and so your boat purifies you, Noach. Okay, I don't understand any of that. Leave aside the Greek, I don't understand any of that. First of all, just to explain, Mitzorah is a person who has what's called Tzara'at. The Torah spends considerable real estate in the middle of the book of Vayikra, of Leviticus, when it thinks you're not looking, in describing what's called Tzara'at. The Torah does not say why a person gets tzara'at. We do not get any explicit reference to explain it. It simply says, when a person contracts tzara'at, which are described in the Torah as marks on one's skin, or one's clothing, or one's home, then what the person has to do is go to the Kohen. The Kohen looks at the person. The Kohen determines that, in fact, this is tzara'at. If it's not tzara'at, you go home and you're fine. Except you have spots. Assuming it is tzara'at, then there's a ritual involving quarantine and involving going into mourning. And then, after a period of time, a couple of weeks, either it goes away, and then you have a ritual of purification involving bringing various offerings, or it stays, and then there are other options depending on whether you're talking about tzara'at on the body or on the car, or on the house or whatever it is. It's a longer discussion. But the tendency is to translate tzara'at as leprosy. It's not leprosy. The leprosy is a disease that involves things like limbs falling off, and that's never associated with this biblical tzaraat. Moreover, leprosy is a physical ailment, and it's very clear from the rules that the Torah sets up, like having the Kohen examine the person, and the person isn't said to have tzaraat unless the Kohen identifies it, and all sorts of rules that are connected to that. It's very clear that it's viewed as something spiritual, somehow inflicted by God. Yes?
I'm trying to remember, I think when Moshe asks for something to prove that he is a prophet,
yes,
Hashem gives him intermittent tzaraat.
Correct. When Moshe says the Jews aren't going to believe me, so three things happen. He's given three signs. The first sign that he's given is that his staff turns into a snake. And then the sign that he's given is he puts his hand inside his shirt and he takes it out, and it is mitzarat kashaleg. It is white, like one who has tzarat. And then the third is the water turning into blood. So 100% true, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. The tzaraat shows up, let me hold off on that for 1 second though, right? But you're right. The tzaraat shows up in Chumash and in Tanakh as a divine punishment. So one example seems to be what Shana pointed out with Moshe, where Moshe is guilty of saying the Jews aren't going to believe me, which is a slanderous statement about the Jews. Who would imagine the Jews not believing Moshe about something? Never could happen. Nonetheless, Moshe is criticized for making such a statement, and in that context, having the staff turn into a snake, remember the snake we talked about last week, represents Lashon Hara, this that, you know, he speaks about God to Chava, so it's now showing up there, and the hand showing up with tzaraat. In another example, Ara points out that Miriam has tzaraat after she speaks about Moshe. Right? We find cases like this in Tanakh that lead us to that idea. There's a play on words, another case of paranomasia, in which one of the sages in the Talmud says that mitzora itself, the term for someone who has tzaraat, is a play on motzi shem ra, someone who gives somebody a bad reputation. Mitzora motzi ra, is the play. Yes?
So are they connecting it to the Yonah?
Interesting. They're not going to make an explicit connection, but let's think about that one as we go along, because I can see where you could make that association. So keep it in mind. I think it's a worthwhile point. Particularly as we play out what exactly the Mitzora's nest is. The only weakness in associating it specifically with harmful speech is that the Talmud itself describes tzaraat as a punishment for various things, not only for that. And then, coupled with that, you have the problem that Talmudically, tzaraat is sometimes not a punishment at all, but it's a physiological phenomenon. So, for example, if you're familiar with the practice traditionally of separating meat and fish, that we wouldn't eat them at part of the same thing, but rather a person will have, let's say, fish, and then they'll eat some bread, and they'll wash their mouth out with something, and then after that they'll have meat. So the Talmud says that that's actually a health measure. It's not about a mitzvah, but it's a health measure because somebody who cooks the two together is vulnerable to tzaraat. Now, what they're talking about and how the omega-3 acids are interacting or whatever, I can't say. And I don't know what they were referring to, but that's not our point. The point is that they're talking about it there, not as you've done something evil and therefore you're getting a punishment, but simply they're saying there's some kind of an illness that's going to befall a person as a function of having done this. So, I bring all of that just as a detour to explain what Mitzora is here. But what are we talking about when we talk about purification via a nest? So take a look at source number 6, please. We're going to have to see sources 6, 7, and 8. Let's start with number 6. This is talking about a yoledet, a woman who gives birth. After a woman gives birth, she goes through a period of time in which she is considered to be tehora. She is considered to be, well, start first. She goes through a period where she is considered to be tameh. She is some kind of ritual impurity where she can't eat from temple offerings, that sort of thing. Then she goes to a much longer period where she is considered to be automatically tahor. She's automatically pure. She cannot be considered tameh. And then after that, she brings certain offerings. So, if take a look at source number 6. Uvimlot yemei tahara. At the completion of her days of purity, leveno levat, after giving birth to a son or daughter, because the times vary for each, tavi keves ben shnaso le'ola, she shall bring a yearling lamb as an ola. An ola is a burnt offering. It all goes up on the altar. Uven yona otor lechatat, as well as a dove or a pigeon, as a sin offering. El Pesach Oel Moed El HaKohen, to the entrance of the tent of meeting to the Kohen. So, there, as part of this process which is going to make her eligible to again eat from sacrifices, from Karbanot, she has to bring, among other things, a bird. Okay, that's one reference. Well, we're going to come back to that. Yes, but we have to come back to it. Hang in there. The second reference is a little further along in the book of Vayikra of Leviticus, source number 7. Vitzivah Kohen, Vilakach Lamitaher, Shteit Siparim, Chayota Harot, Ve'etz Erez, Ushni Talad, Ve'ezov. This is the purification process for the Mitzorah. And it says, the Kohen shall instruct and take for the person who is going to become pure, shtei tziporim chayot taharot, two live, pure birds, meaning from kosher species, as well as cedar and red wool and hyssop. So the birds are going to be used for his purification. That's the mitzvah. And then the third and last one in the set, source number 8, Uvayom Hashemini, Yikach Lo Shnei Torim O Shnei Bnei Yonah. On the eighth day of the purification process, he shall take two pigeons or two turtle doves. Ubalifnei Hashem El Petach Ol Moed Untanam El HaKohen. He shall go before God at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall give them to the Kohen. So, who is this talking about? This is talking about somebody who experienced ziva. Ziva is genital discharge. Particular kind of discharge that is a sign of something being wrong, some kind of illness. And the passage here says that the person with that, who is called a zav, if he's a male, a zava for a female, is supposed to also bring birds for purification. Okay. Take a look at number 9, please, where Medrash asks the question of why you're bringing birds for purification. And asks it regarding Mitzorah specifically. This is Yalkut Shimoni. Yalkut Shimoni is a late collection of Midrashim, but the names of the people it's quoting are people who are already from long before the Medrash is actually written down. Rabbi Yeshua Halevi is the first generation of the Amoraim, the sages of after the time of the Mishnah, middle of the 3rd century. Causes quite a bit of confusion, because the last of all Mishnayot ends with a quote from Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, and so that leads people to wonder what it's doing there if Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is not a sage of the Mishnah. But it seems to have been added on because it's a very fitting end for Mishnah. But in any case, that's not the point. Take a look at number 9. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, Mipnei ma amra Torah, Mitzara yavish tziporin letaharato. Why does the Torah say, he asks, that a mitzara should bring two birds for his purification? What's up with the two birds? And so it reminds us that we are taught that sarat is a punishment specifically for bad speech. So, hu asa ma'ase patit? He chirped. Okay, lipatpeit is to chirp at something. It indicates a little bit of taking something lightly. But he chirped. Amra Torah yavi karban petit. So the Torah says, bring an offering that chirps. He was like a bird. He kept on squawking. V'chein b'day kehuna mechaprin. For that matter, we are also taught that the clothing worn by the Kohen also serves as atonement for the nation for their sins. Why that's so is a longer discussion, but they mention specifically Me'il Mechaper Lashon Hara, the Me'il tunic, atones for harmful speech because the Me'il has bells on the bottom of the tunic. So Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God declares, Yavo Davar Shebekol V'Chaper Maaseh HaKol, the item that has a voice as the bells ring will atone for the sin of the voice when he spoke slanderously as he did. So that's the association they bring for the birds with the Metzora. Okay, now that we know a little bit about bringing birds as purification for something that one went through, we have three different cases here, what questions should we have?
It's one thing to say that's for the Metzora. One wonders why would... We don't really know what a Zav and a Zava are, really. What did they do that they need to bring a sin offering? And definitely strange that the woman who gave birth is bringing a sin offering.
Right, so a few things here. Number one is the in terms of the Zav and the Zava, just in general, the Talmud understands it to be physiological rather than some kind of punishment. There's just something that it was a physical thing that happened. Why then is any sort of purification needed is a good question, and especially because they're also going to have this chatat. Second question to ask is, why is a woman who gave birth bringing a sin offering, or what's called here a sin offering, a good question? What other questions can we ask that tie back to our Midrash in source number 4 in particular? Shana?
How is Noah going to get what's happening on the boat?
Or what is he?
Well, it's not happening on the boat. The boat is the purification.
Why are we connecting him to this concept of bringing a sin offering?
Yes. Well, the cane is the instrument of purification, and we're saying that the boat is giving purification. That part I thought I understood. Don't take that away from me. But I don't understand, how did Noah become a Metzora? How did Noah become a Metzora? Why does Noah need purification? How is the boat providing purification? Right, all of these are good questions. I mean, what is this about? Why, who, and how? All of it is very hard to understand here. Why did we call him Noach Metzora? Maybe we should call him Noach Yoledet. I mean, why do we associate Noach with Tzara'at, as opposed to other things? Noach hasn't even spoken yet, for goodness sake. Right? There's no speech. Noach has not yet had a line of dialogue. He could not possibly have slandered anybody. Yes?
As the Yoledet, he makes sense, so to speak, because he is about to beget the world.
Ah, but then the boat should be after that. I don't understand anything, so we're really stuck here. But I will wonder, just because Rebecca made the point before, can we make the association between the two birds that he's going to send out at the end, the raven and the dove, and the two birds of purification? Can we find a way to link that? And one of them is the burnt offering, and one of them is the sin offering, or something definitely to consider.
Or even the idea that, Noah was saved, but that doesn't mean that he was tahor, let's say, or worthy of Torah, but he was the one who was saved, and maybe he has to go through some process to... I mean, whether it's that he lived through the destruction, which might be considered some form of tumah, or that he has to, in order to go back to living, because maybe being in the table was a sort of a suspended state, in order to come back to the world of the living, he has to go through some process to enable him to re-enter the world of Tahara.
So, it's a good point, and I think it introduces a key question that we need to ask here. And I'm going to leave off with this question. And that is, how do we view purification? There are two different ways we can take it. At least two, but two that I'll go through. One is a person has done something wrong and needs to have it corrected. The other approach is you didn't do anything wrong, but you went through a phase of ineligibility and need to become eligible again. Purification without any moral overtone And really, it's a difference between what we call in Hebrew, kapara and tahara, and in English, atonement and purification. It's entirely possible to suggest that purification has no moral element. It's simply, you were impure, he's been around an awful lot of death, and now you need to become pure. Or to read it as, in fact, you did something wrong, and now it has to be corrected, and that's what the offering is going to do. So that's something we need to think about as we go through this. Is it about Noah needing something corrected, or is it simply Noah needs a ritual to leave the old world behind and become part of something new? There's a lot we have to see with this. This is not an easy medrash, but I think that's a key question that we need to ask. Yeah.
And we fall into that, especially when we translate to the topic.
Yep.
And if we didn't use the English terminology, we might not fall into this idea of thinking of being
right.
Pure and...
Absolutely. Well, even that is itself a problem. Even the words pure and impure are a problem. Let me explain what that means. The Talmud discusses why it is that in certain cases, the Torah, instead of saying tamei, says einena tehora. Why didn't it just say tamei? And it says, because what we want to do is convey that you should use clean speech. Instead of saying tamei, say not tahor. But in English, the translation that we use, impure, is exactly that. Impure means not pure. There is no good translation for the word tamei. We associate, people say things like contaminated. But that has a dirtiness to it that doesn't necessarily fit the word tumah. We don't have a good translation for tumah in English. Even saying impure is really just saying not tahor. I'm going to stop with this at this point because we could go on forever with it. But there's so much to see. So please make sure to be back here next week as we tackle this medrash.